They say a culture may be judged by how it treats its children. If such is the case, we ask, how should a culture be judged that feeds its poor and dispossessed children psychotropic medicines?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1023rd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Portofino who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Happy roll with Michael.
Folks, we are taking a lot of psychotropic medications to correct our thinking, and we're taking a lot more every year. In 2003, we took $2.8 billion worth of psychotropics. By 2013, we were taking $18.2 billion, which is like a 10-year increase of 650% more. Wow. The number of children being fed psychotropics increased by over 300% during this period. 3.2 million children between the ages of 6 and 17 are now estimated to be being fed psychotropic drugs. According to Consumer Reports, the increase in psychotropic drug use by children is not really the result of an epidemic of mental illness, but rather because medical doctors are increasingly using the drugs to treat behavioral problems. And much of the increase in childhood uses is in the Medicaid population of the poor and dispossessed. That so many psychotropic drugs are fed to so many children with little or no official research as to the efficacy of the treatment leads us to ask, how should a culture that feeds its children psychotropic medications be judged? Well, here to help us research and answer, we have a research psychiatrist from Columbia University, Dr. Mark Olson. Doctor, welcome aboard. So pleased to have you in the Food Chain.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
You're a psychiatrist, and what is the difference now between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
Well, psychiatrists are medical physicians who've gone on beyond graduation from medical school to get specialized training in mental health. Psychologists are not physicians, but they've specialized in treating mental health more from a psychological perspective. They don't have the authority to prescribe medications, where psychiatrists...
Okay, so you're a doctor. You can prescribe medications.
Yes.
And you're a research psychiatrist. What does that mean?
Well, that means that for what I do during the day and often at night is I spend my time, studying different aspects of psychiatric illness and their treatment. And my particular area of interest has to do with how medications and other mental health treatments are used in populations, including, you know, the United States generally.
Well, that would be good because that's exactly what we're talking about today. We always ask our guests on the Food Chain who pays the way. So who pays for your research?
Well, you know, some of my research is paid for by the state of New York. So I'm a research psychiatrist for the state of New York. But the part that isn't is paid for by the federal government through grants and contracts.
Okay, good enough. So that you're not getting any funding from the pharmaceutical industry?
That's right.
And my next question in puzzling this over is, how does one conduct objective research in a world that's so dominated by money? I mean, there's so much money in these drugs. How can you walk the line?
Well, you know, I think one of the issues that needs clarification is just that point, is to look at trends and patterns in use of these medications, you know, in different populations, particularly in vulnerable populations, so like children and the elderly, disadvantaged populations and so forth, to try to get that point out, that sometimes decisions are being made in terms of treatment that aren't necessarily in the patient's best interest. So that itself, I think, is a legitimate area for research. But then beyond that, you know, there needs to be research to try to understand how effective these drugs are. And one of the things that, that concerns me is that over the last few years, there's been a reduction in the amount of federal funding in this area at a very time when more and more people are using these medications, and we really need to understand where they're helpful and where they're not. That is, we need to understand more about their risks. The amount of research outside of the pharmaceutical industry is for these sorts of questions has diminished, and I think that that's a serious issue.
So it would seem to be a serious issue because we're taking many more of these medications and studying their effect very much less than.
Right. Let me if I can just amplify that a little bit. You know, this is something that I don't think is commonly understood. That is, when drugs are approved, they're approved by, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, they're approved for specific indications. But once they're approved and they're available, any physician can prescribe them for any condition. So the, sort of the gate opens. There are several important issues here, but that's one of them. And I don't know how commonly understood that is. So, you know, I can be a pediatrician, so I'm not a psychiatrist, and I can still prescribe some of these psychiatric medications, and I can prescribe them if I want to for indications or for reasons that they haven't been actually studied in.
So somebody can invent a medication for headaches, and a medical doctor can
right.
prescribe that medication for toenail fungus.
That's exactly right. So there's sort of two areas here. There's one is you can prescribe it outside of where it's been approved, and you also don't have to be an expert in the area of the disorder or illness that you're trying to treat.
So that's a pretty good indication of where we're heading today. Well, let's step back a minute and mm-hmm. look at the overall trend. 600% increase in the sales of psychotropic medications over the past 10 years. What did we go crazy?
Well, you know, I think there's very little evidence that there's been an increase in serious mental health problems, either among children or among adults. So, you know, that would be like the easiest explanation, but there's very little evidence to suggest that. So then you're left to say, well, is it possible that in the old days, several years ago, there were a lot of people running around who had these problems that weren't being treated, and finally we're getting around to treating them. And that may be a part of it, but it seems to me a much larger part of it is there's been sort of a change in the threshold of what people accept, both physicians and their patients, as being legitimate targets for these drugs.
So maybe we just changed the definition of crazy, and now we're all crazy, instead of before where only a few of us were crazy.
Well, that's one of the concerns, that there's been a real broadening in the concepts of and the whole conceptualization of what these things are. But there's another factor at work here, and that is that you can say that this is all the drug companies, or you can say this is all physicians, or you can say these are parents who aren't, you know, going the extra mile for their kids and sort of turning too early to these things. I'm not sure that any one of them really captures. It's a very complicated thing, very hard to pin down. I do think that part of it, though, is that the lack of availability of alternative treatments. Let me give you an example that's a little bit outside of psychiatric medications, but it's close enough that it's instructive. You know, one of the problems that the United States is facing is this big epidemic in use of prescription narcotics, drugs like OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so
the opiate derivatives.
That's right. So these are sort of painkillers that are being used recreationally, and they're being prescribed by physicians. So these aren't heroin, these aren't street drugs in that sense. And it turns out more people today are dying of overdoses of these drugs than are dying of things like heroin, illegal drugs. And so you step back and you look at this, and you can see the United States is way ahead of other countries in terms of how many of these drugs are used on a per population basis, how many of these prescriptions are written. Like, you know, to give you a sense, it's 40 times more
Ooh.
Than Japan. And, you know, Japan is also an industrial, you know, relatively high-income country. And then you say, well, there must be some cultural differences. And there is. You know, in Japan, you have like 7% of the population or so, the adult population, getting acupuncture, getting alternatives. So they're taking advantage of alternatives for managing pain. We don't do that very much with mental health problems in the United States. We, you know, to bring us back to what we're talking about today. So So most of these kids were being started on these medications. I haven't had counseling or psychotherapy or anything like that first.
Mm-hmm. So
that's a big part of it. This is sort of a symptom of a larger problem of turning to these things, these medications, too quickly.
Wow. Well, folks, here we go. What do you think? How should a country be judged that feeds its poor and dispossessed children psychotropic medications? That's the subject on the table today. We have help searching out an answer. We're from Dr. Mark Olson from Columbia University, research psychologist, and yours truly, Michael Olson. An Olson and an Olson. The Vikings are on, I guess, right?
It's
the Vikings on the food chain this morning, and we're talking about the psychotropic medications that are increasingly used to treat things that really they weren't designed to treat. And how on earth are we going to come to grips with this one? Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, the numbers aren't too attractive at all. According to Consumer Reports, the number of children taking powerful antipsychotic drugs has nearly tripled over the last 10 to 15 years. Center for Disease Control, 7.5% of the children, 6 to 17, are taking prescribed medications for emotional or behavioral problems. Oh, my goodness, $20 billion we're spending to manage how we're thinking about things. Tell us a little bit about these medications, Doctor. We've got, there seems to be all kinds of drugs that we're using for behavioral problems. So what are we taking?
Well, you know, I think it depends a lot on the age group. But if we stick with kids for a moment, and because I think that's where mm-hmm. a lot of the concern has been focused, what you see there are the most commonly prescribed of these psychiatric medications for kids are stimulant medications. So these are medications like Ritalin, and they're used to treat ADHD. And there are kids who benefit from this who otherwise wouldn't be able to focus and concentrate in school. But then there are also kids we know, or young, or particularly older kids, who on college campuses who are misusing these drugs and so forth, so they have some abuse potential, and they have you have young people taking these just as a sort of as a study aid. But I think the greater concern, and they represent a smaller group of the prescriptions, but as I mentioned, there's much more evidence that they're being used outside of the areas where we know they're safe and effective, are what are called the antipsychotic medication.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of where we're focusing today. I guess I've seen different terms for them. Antipsychotic is one word. Psychotropics, another. What is the proper term for them?
Yeah, so most people refer to these as antipsychotic medications. So these are medications that are approved. That is, they've been well studied, and we know that they're of some benefit for diseases like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and sometimes people with autism who have a high level of irritability. But when you look to see what they're actually being used for...
Just as backup, just a second.
Yeah.
So they're approved for these very specific targets.
That's right.
And what percentage of the population are we talking about that suffer from psychosis or autism spectrum
age,
and so on?
But yeah, so you talk about schizophrenia, you have a little less than 1% of the population will have schizophrenia. And then if you talk about bipolar disorder, again, it depends on the age, but maybe 2 or 3%.
Okay.
But the idea is that the great majority of these And so those are the real targets of the drug. That's where, you know, we can say there's, and there are people with schizophrenia, some of them are homeless, who would benefit from being on these medications who aren't on them. But in terms of the number of people, there are many more people, especially young people, who are getting these medications and that don't have these illnesses. And they're getting it largely to manage things like aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Or
being bad.
Right.
Which was always me, being bad. So,
and that's the concern.
So I've seen the term SSRI as well. What does that mean?
Yeah. So those are that's short for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Those are antidepressants, medications like, you know, Prozac.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being...
Is that an antipsychotic or is that...
That's a different class of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Those medications, they were in the news about 10 years ago where there's some evidence that they may, for some young people actually, you know, although they're a treatment for depression, they actually make some kids tip them toward being more suicidal. So there was a lot of concern about their safety a little while back.
Okay.
And their use has gone way up over the last 10 or 20 years in young people. And so that's another discussion. So those are really the three most common classes that we touched on.
And we're taking a lot of them.
Now,
one of the subjects I saw was the atypicals, of which the drug, the trade name Abilify, seems to pop up as it's the number one selling drug in the U.S. What is that?
So that's one of the antipsychotics. The antipsychotics are sort of built into two different, into two different categories, the older drugs and the newer drug antipsychotics, which are called atypicals. And
Well, wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense, doctor, because you say that less than 1% of the population needs the psychiatric medication, and yet the Abilify is said to be the number one selling drug in the U.S.
Right. Well, that's just it, is that it's being used much more broadly than it's indicated for in this way. And that's a big part of that.
Wow. Those are two numbers that are really of interest. Now, what about the scientific research with respect to the use of the antipsychotics outside the psychotic population?
Yeah.
Has anybody looked at that?
Well, people have, and there may be, you know, to keep it with children for a minute, there may be, there probably is a very small group of kids who really have very serious disruptive problems. These are kids who are have these temper outbursts where they can actually hurt other kids, and it's a small group, but they may benefit, and you can try them on various kinds of psychotherapy. You can try them on medications like Ritalin, and they still are completely out of control, and they oftentimes can't be managed at home and so forth. They may benefit from these drugs, but that's a small population. It's a much larger group who don't have these diagnoses, any of them, and yet they're still getting these antipsychotic medications. And they're probably getting, as I mentioned, four things related to aggression and irritability.
Mm-hmm. So I saw a survey that suggested 50% of the parents say that the antipsychotics have had a beneficial impact on their child's behavior. But has there been any scientific, you know, surveys to that extent that actually?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that there have been a few studies, but not enough. You know, you need to have sort of two well-controlled studies where you have a comparison group, and then, you know, the Food and Drug Administration will say, yep, and you have to demonstrate their safety. You do both those things, then the FDA will say, yes, this is an approved indication. Well, that none of the drug companies have been successful in doing that with these antipsychotic drugs. But it's still the case clinically. I can tell you that these drugs do very quickly make kids, they sedate them. So they will make kids less aggressive. That's, you know, that's one of the things they do. But they also result in a fair amount of weight gain and increase in their blood, you know, cholesterol and lipid levels. And we don't know much about their long-term safety in terms of the developing nervous system. So they may be setting the kids up for problems down the line, health problems down the line. And, you know, whether they help the kid overall in terms of having a healthy, you know, development, it really depends on the child. I mean, unless you're talking about these much more severe conditions, my guess is that on balance, these medications are not helpful.
Why have we turned to their use to such a great... I was just thinking of yours truly here, the Viking kid from Montana, who flunked second grade because he couldn't pay attention in class. And in those days, they flunked you, and I flunked. And so I had to come to grips with the fact that I was substandard and that the kids I was raised with had moved on and left me behind. And that's really frightening stuff, you know, for a kid. Frightening, frightening stuff. But I did have to come to grips with myself and pull myself together and pay attention. But we're not asking that of children anymore, are we?
No. I mean, my sense is, and this, I don't know how well this has been said, my sense is that schools are, you know, there's much greater emphasis, of course, on testing, and some school districts, they're saying, they're not holding their kids back who are struggling in error. They're saying, if this kid's behavior doesn't shape up, he or she's not welcome back. That puts parents in a bind. They start grasping for anything to be able to keep their kid in the school.
We have the entrance to our story today, really. We have children that are having trouble with behavior.
That's
and
right.
Parents and guardians who go to the doctor, not the psychiatrist, but the doctor, and say, "Doctor, doctor, give me the news." And the doctor looks at the kid and scratches his head and said, "Take this and call me in 2 weeks." Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the impact of psychotropic or antipsychotic drugs on our children. Not just our children, but our poor and dispossessed children who take most of these drugs. You're invited to participate with Dr. Mark Olson from Columbia University, research psychiatrist. The phone number is 831-479-1080. Right back. What do we do with the children who do not behave, who do not pay attention, who do not act as we wish them to act, which is probably most small kids when you get right down to it, because what kind of small kid could sit in class for all those hours and pay attention? Must take a real special person. I certainly wasn't one of those children, and I had to pay the price, and I bet there are lots of kids like that. So what do we do with them today? Well, the easiest thing to do is you take them to the doctor and ask the doctor for help. And why are doctors prescribing antipsychotics for children, doctor?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things is that they don't feel as if they have access to alternatives. And part of this I think, is that they may not feel they have the time or they have the expertise or the confidence to take the problem on themselves, to actually spend the time with the parent to find out what's going on in the home or find out what really is happening with the child. And is this just a child who's got a lot of energy, or is there something going on that really merits some?
But why the antipsychotics?
Well, you know, I think that if you go back a ways, go back several years, you'll see that there are very few drugs of these kinds of drugs of any kind have been studied in kids, or there's much use of them in kids. And so with adults, for example, there are a variety of other kinds of medications that have a long history of use. So the medications are more like what they call benzodiazepines, medications like Valium that reduce anxiety, mm-hmm. and so forth. But there's no history of use of those drugs in kids. So I think that's part of the issue as to why they're turning to antipsychotics, is that there aren't other options in that way. But I think more importantly, the patient comes to the doctor, it's often the mother, and the doc feels that he or she needs to do something right now. And it's just the easiest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had experience probably with other patients where very quickly the behaviors that are concerning either to the school or the mother are brought under control. But the issue is at what cost? And that's the thing that really hasn't been looked at carefully. So I think it's ease of use and the absence of alternatives that contribute mm-hmm. to it. But I don't have a full explanation for it. It is a somewhat puzzling thing, I have to.
Well, I guess the first thing that I would think of is that parents are desperate for help, or caregivers are desperate for help. And so, you know, they look at the doctor and said, fix the kid, you know, that just do it, whatever it takes, fix the kid, please. So that would certainly, you know, provide sufficient inducement for a doctor to fix the kid, whatever, with whatever means they have, which is probably just, you know, the easiest thing, of course, in the world is a pill. Rather than things like discipline and things that take a while. But I can certainly see that. What role have the drug companies played in pitching antipsychotics as behavioral modifications?
Well, you know, I think that there is a there are rules about how you can advertise if you're a drug company. You know, you can only advertise for the things the drugs are approved to, and that's true for advertisements that are directed at physicians and also advertisements that are directed at the public. So they would like to be able to advertise for a wide range. They say that they have a pill that fixes anything that concerns you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're by law, they're unable.
This is the magic pill.
That's right. That would be nothing they would like more, but they're unable to do that by law. However, and occasionally they do overstep the line, the drug companies do, and they get caught, and they have to pay large sums of money. But it doesn't restrain them from trying again, even if they get court settlements for sometimes, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, because there's, you know, these are expensive drugs.
Well, what's 100 million, though, when you're making 20 billion?
Well, that's just right. And so the numbers are really staggeringly large. Some of that may be changing, because what happens is, after a period of time, the drug companies lose their patent protection, and then people are able to make generics, and so the financing and the pressures change. And so some of these atypical drugs, these antipsychotics we're talking about, have recently come off patent, so now they're available in generic form. So there'll be less
money.
There'll be less money in this, but they, you know, they may be migrating over. Who knows? There may be new classes of drugs on their way, for all we know.
Okay, let's go to the phones, 831-479-1080. Folks, you're talking with Dr. Mark Olson, who is the research psychiatrist for Columbia University, and this subject we're researching is the impact of psychotropic or antipsychotic drugs on children. Mary, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to ask the doctor if this is not an issue of following the money. I mean, aren't doctors receiving some kind of kickback when they prescribe all of these medications that are being foisted upon them day upon day? I mean, I go to the doctor and I see salespeople come in with briefcases waiting to talk to doctors. I see that at every doctor office I go.
Well, it is not the case that the doctor will get, that he or she will get a certain amount of money for every prescription they write. That kind of behavior is illegal. But the drug companies may do things like take the doctor to a nice restaurant, or do things that provide other kinds of things that are of value to the doctor. And so that isn't, you know what I'm saying? So it's sort of between the lines, if you will. And they're eager, and if they do these things, the doctor will feel compelled to give them their time and listen to their sales pitch. So they'll be about the drugs. So there's no question that the drug companies do have an influence on prescribing practices, but it's not quite as direct as being paid for each prescription.
Mary?
Okay. Thank you for that. That answers a big question for me.
Okay, good. 831-479-1080, Dr. Mark Olson on the line. We're talking about antipsychotics and children. Now, one of the things that really struck me in looking at this subject was the fact that most of the antipsychotic medications are going to the poor and the dispossessed children. Why is that?
Well, you know, the very highest rates of use of these antipsychotic and some of the other medications are, you're right, they're in the populations that many people have that have Medicaid, or even that even higher rates of use are among that subgroup of Medicaid patients who are in the kids who are in the foster care system.
So they're the dispossessed.
That's right. And so they're often, you know, they don't have their biological parents advocating for them. They're, you know, they're literally wards of the state. And, you know, why that is something that people are just now kind of getting around to trying to figure out. I think there have been enough studies documenting that it is a fact, and trying to understand what its determinants are. Part of it is that in this, these children, many of them have had traumatic experiences.
Yeah, it's
they are presenting with.
Can you hold that, Doctor? We're going to come pick that up when we come back. We're going to talk about the poor and the dispossessed children, and why they are the ones that are receiving most of the antipsychotic medications, and what does that mean as for us as a culture that we feed our children, and especially our poor and dispossessed children, antipsychotic medications. 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Mark Olson and you right back. Well, folks, imagine yourself a foster parent. You're in the system and you take care of children who have been rejected for one reason or another by their parents, or left alone in the world without parents, and thus suffer the damage of that rejection. And bound to, if you're that foster parent, you have a dozen or so kids, or six or seven or whatever, you're bound to have some behavior problems on your hands. So what do you do? Well, you can address the issue as a loving parent might, with tender loving care and firm discipline, the combination thereof. Or you can just get some pills and, here, kid, take this and behave. Is that what's going on, Dr. Mark Olson?
Well, you know, I think what's going on is that it just there isn't a broad enough appreciation for the impacts that, you know, that the traumatic experiences and some of the actual outright abuse that some of these children have experienced and how they present with it. You know, if you think about what they call post-traumatic stress disorder, this is something that
all of these kids have, right?
Well, yeah. As psychiatrists and psychologists, mental health professionals, they're not trained in how to recognize this in children. You know, if you even step back further from that, if you go back, say, 20 years or so, people weren't even trained how to recognize depression in kids, you know, in like adolescents. They used to think of childhood as being a happy period in development. And in fact, for some kids it is, but for many kids it's not. And so.
Yeah, I flunked second grade.
So you had trauma. Confront, right?
Yeah.
The adult world has been kind of slow to pick up on the fact that, kids' experiences are just as complicated and trying as adult experiences are. And the ways of coping and trying to get by can be very complicated and take many forms. There isn't nearly as much effort, generally speaking, spent on studying and trying to understand and teach healthcare what's helpful for kids.
A lot of work.
Well, that's true. It is, but it's obviously where our future lies, and so it's important work and work that needs to be.
So there it is. That is our future. So tell me, Dr. Mark Olson, research psychiatrist from Columbia University, what happens to children when they take antipsychotics?
Well, you know, the thing is, we don't know in the long run, and that's part of the scary part of this, is that these medications we don't have a system for studying, and neither does any other country for system.
So we don't know what we're doing.
That's right. And so there's an element of real uncertainty. We do know something about the side effects some of the well-known side effects. I mentioned before, many of these antipsychotics are associated with weight gain, and we already have in this country a serious problem with overweight and obese kids. So for those kids that happen to come into these with, you know, a weight issue, and then they're given these medications on top of, we know that can make things, you know, much worse.
Doctor, there are probably several thousand websites tracking the correlation between mind-altering pharmaceutical medications and murder, mass murder. People point to all of the mass murderers that are going on, and they say these people are on antipsychotic medications. How, in the first place, how do they know that? Is there any truth to it?
Well, you know, the relationship between, just generally speaking, the relationship between violence and mental illness is one that's obviously very important to society, and one that various people have looked at. Certainly, when it comes to adults, the strongest connections are with substance abuse and and criminal violent behavior.
But what about these children that are arming themselves with guns and shooting up schools and stuff like that? The you know, the websites point to them and say these kids are on antipsychotics.
Well, you know, I mean, there are going to be cases. I just don't know. It is a very hard thing to really nail down and say that the, you know, that any medication tripped any particular behavior. I mean, I think that because you don't know what the experience would have been without the medication. You don't know whether the violence would have occurred. And it's what's called the counterfactual. It's possible. It's certainly a hypothesis we need to be thinking about, given the level of violence we have in our society. We need to be trying to. You know,
we're not even thinking about it, are we?
That's right.
Do you think these medications alter behavior or smother behavior?
Well, I think it depends on the medication. I think generally, if you have giving an antipsychotic to a young person who doesn't have a psychotic disorder, and again, that's the great majority of the people who get these antipsychotics don't have it. Psychotic disorders. What you're doing is dampening down behavior. They have a kind of a leaden effect. And if the primary concern in the world of adults is the child is being irritable or being aggressive or being impulsive, those things will be dampened, but so will a lot of other things. So mm-hmm. will the child's capacity to experience pleasure and happiness and engage with their friends and explore the world. And, you know, so that, as I say, these things come with real costs.
And when we get back, that will be the question, what are the real costs of feeding our children antipsychotic, psychotropic drugs that alter their perception in ways nobody knows because nobody is really looking at it? That's the question on the table, 831-479-1980. What do you think? How do you think a culture should be judged that feeds its children, its poor and dispossessed children, antipsychotic medications? How should it be judged? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dr. Mark Olson. The Vikings are on today on the Food Chain Radio Program with you. Please do stay tuned. Well, and it gets right down to the nitty-gritty. Children are the future. No children, no future. How your children grow up is how your future will shape up. And so a very frightening thing to me in considering the subject of drugging our children with psychotropic medications is we seem to be, as a society, paying folks to have children they can't afford or simply don't want. And so we're warehousing those children and then drugging them into oblivion with medications. Dr. Mark Olson, am I crazy?
Well, you know, there certainly is, in my view, a problem with overuse of these medications. And, of course, the antipsychotics in many ways are the most powerful medications. And in children, we see this clearly. I have to think, you know, as we've talked and we've covered over the last hour, a lot of different, you know, potential sources of this issue. But I think one of them that we haven't touched on is the attitudes that adults have about psychiatric medications. And a few years ago, there was a national study. They asked adults, you know, whether they agreed with the general statement that psychiatric medications are helpful to deal with day-to-day stress. So they weren't asking about whether they're helpful to deal with serious psychiatric illnesses, but day-to-day stress. And what they found is that over 70% of American adults agreed with that proposition. And so, you know, part of me, I can't help but think that part of what we're seeing with children, and the extensive use of these drugs is just a reflection of the attitudes that the adults have about these medications.
Where else could it come from?
Right, right.
Where else could it come from? It has to come from us. And so what does that say about us?
Well, you know, I think the pendulum has swung a long way. I'm hopeful that it will begin to swing back. The alternative kinds of treatments require more effort, though, and
yeah.
They require more engagement. I think when people stop, though, hopefully to think about the seriousness of the decisions they're making in terms of their health, in terms of their children's health, that the issue of how much effort you have to put into that will recede into the background, and that they won't opt for what is kind of an easy solution but may not be the safest solution in the long run, and that they'll give more thought to other ways of approaching these problems.
And it really is the easy way if you think about it, because
right.
It's all you have to do is go down to the doctor and say, doctor, give me the news, give me some pills, and they do. And what about a law that would prevent the use of antipsychotic medications to manage simple behavior problems? I mean,
well, yeah, there are beginning, you know, there's some in California and in Texas, there have been some legislation, and the way they often work, or they're starting to work, is that they don't literally prevent it, but they say that what happens when you take the prescription to the pharmacist won't just automatically fill it. He or she will call the doc, and the doc will have to, you know, go through an additional step.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of slowing it down a little bit has the effect of decreasing the number of prescriptions that are written. So it's short of a hard stop.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Mark Olson, research psychiatrist from Columbia University, we thank you for calling our attention to the fact of how precious our children are and how we really need to start thinking about how we're prescribing medications for them. Folks, I think we're going to file this story under Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. Thank you, Doctor, and thank you all for tuning in.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.